I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the accounts payable. That would be cycle date 8-12 through 8-16. It would include the regular checks payable of $926,052.78 and the payroll and payroll associated warrants of $742,355.90. Total warrants approved $1,668,408.68. Noting the county manager reviewed and approved such.
Second.
Other discussion? Items of note?
Sure, Epps. I'm to mention to you first payment to Duckland Construction. This is from the Road and Bridge Infrastructure Pool for the Green Truss Bridge replacement. Payment of $283,297.55. Payment to Kilgore Company. This is from the Road and Bridge budget. This is from the gravel, the spot gravel program. Did some work on County Roads 54 and 62. Payment of $94,145.89. Payment to Old Castle Group. This is Road and Bridge budget. This is from the asphalt patch program and work on County Roads 36, 62, 64, 129, and several others. Payment of $100,925.31. Payment to Giovanni Construction LLC. This is from Building and Plant Pool, and this is for Fairgrounds Improvement Project. And there, we are still holding retained earnings for this project, $32,936.50. And payment to Safe Construction Company of Northwest Colorado. This is also from the Building and Plant Pool, and this is for the gel flower shower floor coating project, remove and replace the shower floor coating. Payment of $13,410.90. And finally, payment to Bear Communications Inc. This is from the Conn Center Pool, and this is payment for the cost to move the communication systems from the old building to the combined law enforcement facility. Payment $50,202.65. Any other questions you may have?
All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. We had our work session yesterday with updates from the county manager, legal, public works, accounting, CSU extension, and public health.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve consent agenda items A and B.
Second.
Any other discussion? So item B, we have a resolution number on that. That will be resolution number 2019-053. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Now it is.
Great. All right, so we have our update. This is, do we do this quarterly? Is that correct?
We started out quarterly, going back 14 years ago.
All right,
but actually now we do it typically three times a year, but it's typically on a quarter. So
all right, that's well, why I'll just call it our regular update. We have a regular investment update. So if each of you would just introduce yourselves for the record, and then Deanna will have you write your names down for her when you, just so she can make sure she spells them correctly.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm Julie Hughes with Chandler Asset Management.
Scott Prickett with Chandler Asset Management.
Lane Yakubito from County Treasurer.
All right, you can just go ahead and give us your...
Okay, great. Sorry I missed the last meeting. And Julie's going to give us the economic update, and then I'll go into the portfolio.
Sounds good.
To give you guys a little perspective on our investment environment, so we've had a very, very volatile market, which I'm sure...
We've heard.
You've
yes.
heard, unless you have been living under a rock. We have really the global economic situation is really dominating what we're experiencing here in the United States. So It seems that our economic health is still relatively strong. It is slowing, but it is still relatively intact. However, we're being influenced very heavily by the slowdown in the rest of the world, Eurozone and China. And then, of course, we have the trade situation, which is really exacerbating that problem and really causing a lot of angst in the markets, which really drives a lot of money into U.S. treasuries. And we have very low rates across the globe and declining all the time based upon what we're seeing with the global slowdown. So to get into some of the details, page 4 here, as a reminder, the Fed is really our primary determinant of short-term interest rates, and they have a dual mandate. First part of the mandate is maximum employment. So you're still seeing a very strong labor market here in the United States. We have non-farm payroll growth. See a little bit of volatility month to month. Our latest month was 164,000 jobs being created. The trend is down to about 140,000 jobs on a monthly basis, which is a decline from earlier in the year. But that typically happens as you reach full employment. So we are pretty close to full employment, as defined by the Fed. We have a 3.7% unemployment rate, which is about the lowest in recent history since the 1960s. The underemployment rate has come down. The piece of the puzzle that has been lagging has been wage growth. We're tracking at about 3.2% year-over-year wage growth, which is still a little bit weak relative to the very low level of unemployment that we've been seeing. So this part of the mandate really is being met and has been met for some time now and is really generating the growth that we are seeing in the economy as a good employed workforce. As we flip to the next page, the second half of the Fed's dual mandate is stable prices. And the Fed has really been targeting around a 2% inflation rate. And their preferred gauge is the chart that you see on the right, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which is a more dynamic index than CPI, although you know, CPI is used for cost of living indexes, and you see that in the headlines a lot. It is meaningful, but the Fed really focuses on the PCE. If we look at our core number, which strips out the volatile food and energy, which is the dotted line here, you can see that it's tracking at about 1.6% year over year. So that's well below the Fed's 2%. And it's not like it just happened. You can see the trend has been below 2%. So that is something the Fed cited in their last meeting. So they did cut rates at their last meeting in July. They cut by a quarter point. So we're now to down to 2 to 2.25%. And the low inflation rate and inflation expectations was one of those key reasons that they cited, along with the global tensions and slowing global economy. We look at the yield curve, and we'll get to that a little bit later. You can see that investors have priced in at least 3 more rate cuts. Fed funds futures are showing 100% probability right now for another quarter point cut at the September meeting. And the market is generally thinking we're going to see a more dovish Fed, if you will, cutting rates.
Let's go borrow some money.
Where you want to borrow is in Germany, because it's negative, about 70 basis points at the 10-year point. So that's where you want to go borrow your money. And then
I don't think we can
they can
that.
Pay you interest on that.
I have a question going back to wage growth and inflation. So wage growth is low, but inflation is also low. And so what did you say, 3% wage growth?
3.2%.
And so we got 1.5, so we have a differential of 1.7% between wage growth and inflation. Historically, what does that look like looking back through the years? I mean, is that a good differential? Because, you know, it's true that wage growth has been really slow. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, it's still more than the inflation rate. So
right.
Is that, I mean, how much of a good thing is that? Or?
Well, I'll say this. Historically speaking, for this level of unemployment, 3.7% unemployment. We should see wage growth 3.5 to 4%.
But would we not also at the same time see inflation? That's why thinking about that differential isn't so bad.
Yes, and they all kind of go together if you think about it. Interest rate levels. So right now we're at about 1.5%.
Yep.
Pretty much across the curve, interest rate levels and inflation rate should be in the same zone. Do you have any historical
perspective?
I guess the point I'm saying is that everybody, you hear a lot of talk about how disappointing wage growth is, but in this low inflation environment, it's not that bad.
It's kind of irrelevant.
Sometimes, though, you expect to get wage inflation, so the flow through happens. So, okay, we have 3.2%. Historically, it should be 3.7. That 3.7, in theory, quote unquote, would result in wage inflation. So it's the chicken and the egg, so to speak. In this case, you know, you've got the wage inflation generating higher inflation to catch up with it, but it's not happening.
Thank you.
All right. So moving on to page six, the consumer really is about 2/3 of our economic growth. And retail sales here on the left have been relatively strong. July just came in at about 3.4% year over year. You see some big dips here. Some of that is auto related. So you have gasoline prices in here and autos that causes some of this volatility in the chart. But overall, it's a strong, strong balance sheets and strong spending trends for consumers. Consumer confidence remains high, historically speaking. We have recently seen a dip in the other index that we track, which you don't see on here, the University of Michigan. So everything that's going on with the markets and the tariffs and everything is starting to impact not spending, not employment, but some of the confidence that the consumer is seeing. Relatively speaking, though, if we look big picture on a historical chart, it's still very healthy.
We'll see this for August. Do this, will we?
Maybe.
So back to the retail sales year over year. So that, so like if you look at June of 17, so that's 3% over what it was in June of 16.
Correct.
That's correct.
So measure for each month.
Right.
That's correct.
Exactly.
Okay. Yep.
And then on the next page, we have two very broad indices of economic activity. So the leading economic indicators has about 10 indices that are tracked within this one number. And you get a lot of volatility month to month. The CFNAI here on the right is extremely robust. It's got about 85 different numbers that are tracked in here. And this is more on a moving average basis. But overall, you can see the trend for both are on the decline. And neither is pointing towards a recession. Both are pointing towards slower growth. If we look at the range here, if, just to give you some perspective, the CFNAI here on the right, if we were to hit that negative 0.7 at the bottom of the chart on a three-month moving average basis, that would be indicative of an oncoming recession in the future. We're not there. We're really at just slower growth, below trend growth, if you will. Just consistent with everything else that we're seeing. And on page eight, we look at housing. You can see a very clear picture here on the right with housing prices, the top 20 markets in the country, really a pretty steady and precipitous decline in price increases. So prices are still increasing overall, just at a decelerating rate. So about 2.4% year over year in our latest reading. We tend to be a little stronger here in Colorado. Our numbers are still higher than this. Some of the very overheated markets that we've seen out west, like the Seattles and San Franciscos, are actually starting to see declines month over month, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's really been overheated. Not so much in Colorado here. We're still seeing increases. And manufacturing here on the next page, Again, a similar story. We're still in the expansion zone rather than contraction, but you see it's a slower level of growth. And this is about 10 to 12% of our economic activity, whereas when we start to look in Germany and China, some of the other very large economies, it's a much bigger percentage of their overall economy, and we're seeing some weakening numbers there, which is really having a lot of impact on our stock market, actually. So it's something to keep an eye on because it is on a slower trend basis. And then finally on page 10 here, everything really adds up to GDP on an overall growth basis for the economy. We had about 2.9% growth for 2018, and we had pretty strong first and second quarter here. The second quarter number is an advanced number of 2.1%. That will get revised probably pretty significantly if history tells us anything. But overall, keeping the big picture in mind for 2019, we're expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5%, which is, you know, much slower than the 2.9% we saw last year. But again, not a screeching halt, more of a slowdown. And the impact this has had on the markets and on interest rates, and which will really feed into the portfolio and the strategy. So you can see the yield chart here on the left. These are 2-year, 5-year, and 10-year. You can see everything peaked October last year and has come down since then, I think much more quickly and dramatically than anybody would have thought. If we look at our yield curves here on the right, the bottom curve is the one that is the most recent, July of 2019. You can see that it is inverted. So we have about 30 basis points of inversion right now between the 10-year Treasury and the 3-month Treasury. 3-month is at about a 185, and the 10-year is at about a 155. The 2-year Treasury, where we're most closely tracking for the county's portfolio, is at about a 150 this morning. So it has come down 30 basis points even in the last couple of weeks with a lot of trade tensions and a lot of talk about slowing numbers in Germany and China and other parts of the world. So what this does also is a lot of safe haven type investors will come in and buy U.S. Treasuries because they don't want a negative interest rate in Germany or somewhere else. They still like a 150 on a U.S. Treasury. So, any other questions?
And those investors are assuming that interest rates will be lower 2 years out.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's a perfect segue and theme into a lot of our purchases for the county's portfolio, which sometimes may seem counterintuitive. Why are you buying a 2-year at a 150 when your overnight money is higher? But we're anticipating lower rates moving forward. So it's kind of locking it in, if you will, for the future. Any other broader economic questions before we get specifically into the portfolio?
So, you're going to tell us when the recession starts and how bad it'll be.
Well, she's doing the economic today. She was the asset portion of myself.
When is the recession starting? I'm predicting it'll be later in Colorado than it is on a broader basis. We at Chandler do not think we will see recession hit in the next 6 months. Beyond that, it's hard to tell, but we are not in the doom and gloom camp that you read and see in some of the sensationalized news out there. We think it will. The fundamentals are there to ride the wave a little bit longer.
Certainly, Colorado going in later wouldn't be. That's the norm. Right. All the recessions we lived through, Colorado's.
Exactly.
Kind of last one in, then last one out.
And then we're that much farther behind all of Colorado.
Yeah, that's right.
Already, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think they're predicting that when it does happen, it won't hit like it hit previously. It'll be shorter, 18 months max.
Do any of us really believe they or them?
I think it's likely that you're right, you know, because of like personal balance sheets. savings rates are high. The debt load is increasing quickly for households. So the balance sheet looks better, but that's changing quickly relative to the household debt. And, believe it if you will, but the tariffs, according to an analyst this morning, and I didn't get the details of the research or where the firm he was at, but he said their research was showing $1,000 per household for the latest round of tariffs.
Yeah, I heard that.
So we'll see if that, combined with the future, see what it holds relative to the possibility of a recession. But it's likely that it probably won't be as bad as it was. Certainly, boy, it's hard to believe that it could be as bad as it was in 2008. But the situation was much different relative.
I mean, the financial institutions are stronger, are they not?
Yes.
We hope.
More safer.
They are much stronger, but unfortunately, they're bigger too. So this, too big to fail has unfortunately been, in my opinion, just an outright failure. Because they truly are still, in fact, it's worse. They are too big to fail. So
when I opened the New York Times this morning, the top headline was about the administration backdoor conversations about fixing the economy in some kind. How much do any of those kinds of actions really have any impact? I mean, how much can he screw it up? That's what I'm saying. A lot?
Go ahead.
Well, the tariffs are the biggest impact that, is top of mind and headline right now. I mean, fiscal policy definitely can have an impact. So, it depends on how broad and how deep the tariffs actually go, or if they reach some semblance of an agreement. And, we've seen numerous projections on what kind of a bite that could take out of GDP, from 1% to 3% to 5%. Depends on how protracted it is and how much, so far it hasn't been significant. But so fiscal policy definitely does have an impact. He's definitely trying to influence monetary policy as well, mm-hmm. which he can't.
Yeah.
I mean, they are independent.
Right.
So, the theoretical, the Fed's going to do. He can influence who's appointed to the Fed and how dovish they may be. But you want to elaborate on that one?
Yeah, I think just the independence of the Fed is just crucial. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he's actually, I think, made it more difficult for Jay Powell and for the FOMC to make independent decisions, because based on what we know about their personalities, and it's quite a bit relative to their history, I think it's easy for a layman to say, oh, geez, look, President Trump said you guys should lower interest rates. Here they are lowering interest rates. Where I think, in my opinion, in reality, based on Jay Powell, Richard Clarida's personalities, we are going to have to lower interest rates, and it's going to look like, because of Trump doing this, that's why we're doing it. And I don't think that's the reason why. I think they're making this. They will probably make this decision in September to lower yields again, 25 basis points, because of what they're seeing in the economy, and more importantly, what they're seeing globally. 10 years ago, in terms of how much credibility they gave to the effects of global concerns on the U.S. domestic economy, that's changed dramatically. From 20 years ago, I mean, especially when I started in the business in 1987, it was like, oh, that's nice. What's the U.S. doing? That's changed dramatically. So with what Julie was talking about with negative yields, overseas and seeing some weaker numbers in the Eurozone, weaker numbers in Asia, that will be imported domestically. It's just how much. So that's a question. So.
Got it.
Such uplifting discussion.
Yeah. That's not all bad.
Yeah, we're not too clear.
Oh, I really enjoy this part of the presentation.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Thank you.
Good.
The rest of it gets less interesting.
As it should be.
That's right.
I will go through it quickly.
No, that's not.
Is that an option?
Projected would be the investment policy.
Oh, okay.
I will, well, and as you know, I mean, that was addressed as well as a new investment directive. So I will integrate that in into the discussion a little bit here as we move forward. And see on the objectives page, it does say in the middle note there, channel asset management performance objective equal to or above the return on the benchmark index. And I'll talk about that as we go through this. That benchmark index has recently changed, recently in the last 12 months. And we've been transitioning the portfolio slightly as a result of that. It's been helpful getting expectations, you know, the market bites, visibility and expectations. As a manager for county, for public funds, we like to have those expectations as well. Lane has done a great job relative to communicating with us in terms of expectations, in terms of the size of the portfolio, and that helps us to establish the portfolio in a structure that's appropriate versus the benchmark. And I'll get into that in a minute. But if you go down to the compliance page, page 14, you'll see that there's just one category underneath local government investment pool. Not necessarily at risk, in fact, maybe on to the contrary, but still within the new policy, we've got 26% maximum, for example, for LGIPs, and we're at 26%. That's being addressed right now. So as of in just a few weeks, that will be taken care of. So otherwise, it complies with all categories. The following page, page 15, you can see the characteristics of the portfolio. Again, the benchmark now is the 0 to 3 year versus the 2 year held to maturity. So, Beth, for a little background, 4 years, in fact, as long as Chandler's been doing it now for 5 years and even more than a decade before that, there was a benchmark for this portion of the portfolio called the 2 year HD. It was a 2 year held to maturity. And that benchmark was appropriate because you could simply, in fact, any public entity could go out and buy a 2 year treasury at auction and hold it to maturity. So at any point in time, there would be 24 treasury positions in there because they're just being held to maturity. And then you reinvest at the auction rate. So that was a benchmark. Real conservative benchmark. It was in association with an association with the language that the county had in terms of the comparable treasury benchmark. That was recently changed, and conservatively so. So how could we add value to the county's portfolio but still do it conservatively? So it moved from that benchmark, which was typically running a duration or a weighted average maturity at slightly less than a year. So we typically run to like 0.9. And the decision was made to add value to the portfolio in the coming years by just slightly increasing the weighted average maturity or duration, if you will, to about a new benchmark, 0 to 3 year, has a duration between like 1.3 and 1.4. So it's just taking the benchmark duration and going from realistically 11 to 12 months out to just slightly longer to about 16 months. And then rather than typically going out 2 years on the curve, we can now go out 3 years on the curve versus the benchmark. We could always do that, but we wanted to stay close to the benchmark. So just know that that change took place within the last 12 months. And it's taken us a long time to transfer this portfolio. Not the least of which reason is because of what we've been talking about this morning relative to, boy, the change of not only market participants like ourselves, but also the Fed. I mean, back in December, everybody was talking about how the Fed's going to increase yields 3 times. Now we're talking about not only did they move, you know, a month ago, but they're going to probably move 3 more times in the opposite direction. So we've always managed this portfolio typically slightly less than the benchmark to add safety to it, safety, liquidity, yield, and we've done that. But that has had an effect on the performance, and I just wanted to give you that background.
Thank you.
I think you guys are aware of that. So with this characteristics page, you can see the new benchmark, the 0 to 3 years reflected there. As I said, average modified duration 1.36, portfolio 1.19. So that's going to be changing. That's 88% of the benchmark. we realistically want to be about 95 to 100% of that benchmark. So over the course of the next few months, I think we'll get it there relative to the benchmark. And then you can see, because of some added funds into this portfolio, the total amount of the portfolio as of July 31 is $31,796,000. And then on the following page, page 16, sector distribution, you can see just a change in the agency component going from 68% to 75%. We saw value there relative to spread levels versus treasuries, and then a slight uptick in the commercial paper exposure from 4% to 5.5%, so just a slightly higher 1.5% allocation there. A little more detail on the issuers page, page 17. Quality distribution, page 18. You can see, as you would expect, everything AA or AAA rated. And then a little more interesting slide, not as interesting as the economic slides, but nonetheless, I'll try and make it somewhat interesting.
Tim will be nice, don't worry.
Page 19, you can see the portfolio versus the benchmark. So the benchmark being the lighter green color there, olive green, and then the darker green, the portfolio. You can see a lot of liquidity in the actual managed portfolio. And then slightly under in what we call the bucket of 2 to 2.5 years. So that will most likely be increasing over the course of the next quarter to two quarters to get in line a little bit closer to the benchmark. We typically don't mimic the benchmark exactly because of our outlook relative to the duration and the sector allocation and the term structure. But we come typically a little bit closer than what this is right now. And then we also debated before we did this presentation, the investment performance. Do we include the two-year held to maturity, what we had been historically managing it versus, or do we include the new benchmark? And so you can see at the very bottom of page 20, because of how we manage the portfolio, we actually been slightly below the new benchmark. Historically, we've been equal or exceeding this benchmark for other public funds, but we just put it in there, and that's what we're going to strive to be moving forward. You see all the way to the right-hand side since inception, if we compare it to the benchmark, even though we haven't been managing it for four and a half out of the 5 years versus the benchmark at a 106 versus 110 for the benchmark. But that compares to the two-year, the old two-year benchmark at a 103. So 106 compares favorably to 103. But I would expect on a total return basis, this portfolio, especially as we extend the duration to about 95%, definitely to look really good versus the pools over the course of the next 6 months. That's making an assumption that the Fed is going to act. They don't even need to move 75 basis points. But if they move 50 basis points, so for example, call it, and Julie touched on this, Collar Trust is paying about a 225 overnight rate right now. That'll slowly still gravitate downward. They move in September, they move one more time, then they're going to be, you know, fairly close to between a 150 and 175. We're looking at that relative to making longer-term portfolio decisions, as well as the benchmark and the structure of the portfolio versus that, because we want to actually add a lot of value versus the LGIPs, but also get in line what we've done historically for versus the 0-3 benchmark. So we're going to be, again, structuring that. It's going to look more appropriate, certainly within the next 6 months, versus that particular benchmark. So
you wouldn't want to go borrow money if they're going to drop the rate three times.
That's true.
Unless you go to Germany.
So people in Germany are actually buying long-term bonds that have a negative return. Why wouldn't they just build a vault and put their cash inside of a vault?
Well, that's a good question. There is, a lot of the
vaults
purchases
are expensive, Tim.
are central bank driven. So that's you know, if you look at the smaller purchases, smaller, quote-unquote, being defined, even as on the institutional side. So you have the central banks as big buyers of that. But so if you exclude that and address your question without getting into the weeds, let's say you assume that in 5 years, Or let's just keep to the German boom. So it's right now at a negative 71 basis points. So there's numerous ways to buy that. But if you want to just discount it, you know, let's say that you're going to pay par. So in 10 years from now, you're going to get less than par at maturity. And not only that, if it's an old historical position and you're getting a coupon, it's going to be adjusted. That par price is also going to be adjusted. So you're going to realize negative 71 basis points over that time period. But who knows? I mean, there's a lot of, it's reflecting fear. And there's a lot of fear out there right now in markets, as well as expectations relative to inflation. So if you think that inflation is going to be negative, let's say 1.5%, wow, you're ahead.
Yeah.
So let's hope that we don't think, and Julie and I and the other portfolio strategists are going to write a white paper for our firm based on negative yields and negative interest rates. And we all agree that it's unlikely to happen here. For various reasons, and as not the least of which is FOMC committee members don't think it's a good idea. A lot of economists don't think it's a good idea. Here, look what's happened in Japan. That hasn't worked out real well for greater than a decade. I don't think it's working out real well in the Eurozone. We'll see. I think, you know, we were talking about this. Now, it could happen here, but unlikely. Let's say that the Fed lowers yields, and I'll try not to bore you much more than 60 seconds here.
But no, this is interesting.
I never know. So thanks for the support. Just don't want to bore you. No, I lost my train of thought here. So
if they drop the rates, yeah.
Yeah, if they drop the rates, and let's say we're at 75 basis points overnight yield, and that's end of 2020, and we're due for a recession. You know, irrespective of the stimulus, you're not going to get rid of the business cycle. Typically, going back about 40 years, it's about one every 7 years.
Right.
So we're 10 years into this now, a little bit more. So you're not going to end the business cycle. Let's say that we're in the end of 2020 and we've got a recession rolling around. They're already down to 75 basis points. They're not going to have, you know, and quantitative easing, we'll see if that happens. Would that push us? We talked about that on the way up here. We think that's the most likely scenario for the possibility, still underlying the possibility of pushing us into negative yields. But I think it would take both of that, and they would do so kicking and screaming, to use a technical term. Yeah. That would be interesting to see Jay Powell kicking and screaming, but I don't think that that's going to happen. And a lot of it's based on economic theory as well.
Is gold irrelevant?
Depends on your age.
Just thought I'd try. Do you have just gold, Tim?
And potato teeth.
But I mean, like I say, depending on, I mean, years ago, that's what would happen. When times get tough, people would race out and buy gold.
You don't even hear about it anymore, do you? I talk to economists our age and people, everybody in this room. It's looked upon differently than people in their 20s. They're like, gold. You know, it's like, look at me like, crazy? How old are you? You know, seriously?
Yeah.
Not, you know, only thinking about the effects of holding gold and currencies and the value of that. I mean, we're looking at bitcoins now. So that's their world. You know, what's it backed by versus, you know, gold.
Yeah. So something you can touch.
Yes, exactly.
Heavy.
Right. So,
yeah. No, I was going to say, you still see some of that relationship, though, mm-hmm. the price of gold.
You're not recommending that we buy gold, though.
It's not in your investment policy. No.
I guess my question here, I mean, we've all, and Trump brags about the stock market and the rest, and how this market is in relationship to the stock market. I mean, hell, if you pick up your 401k and it's like, holy smokes, I should quit working. You know, mm-hmm. and you take out that money and be done with it,
right.
and we capitalize on it now before we go into the next thing. And so, I mean, is this thing kind of ahead of that stock market? Or, I mean, and how's that? I mean, we're talking about different tools, different assets that were investment mechanisms and the rest, and it's just like, and the tariffs and the rest and how they're all fitting together here, I'm really struggling with, again, to look at my 401k and look at my wife's 401k. I mean, it Denver doubled in value in the last 2 years. And it's like, how the hell can that keep going?
I think there are a lot of moving parts, and I think there used to be a more clear relationship that you could draw upon.
Between this and stuff.
So you'd go, I'm seeing a sell-off in equities today, and people are flocking into treasuries. And you still see some of that, but you see a clear disconnect in today's world. And a lot of that is because we're so interconnected with the rest of the world. So some of it could be, we have weak data in Germany. We have foreign investors buying U.S. treasuries today. You know, another thing is we're issuing a lot of T-bills on the short end of the curve to fund the deficit. That is propping up the short end of the curve. Yeah. So there's a lot more at play here, I think, than there used to be. That's sort of mucking up that clearly defined relationship. But, you know, back to the equity piece, it has reached all-time highs. And we are still seeing very healthy company balance sheets. Credit spreads are still really narrow. Earnings are still healthy. The tariffs really haven't cut into that yet, but they might. You know, if that expands or if that continues for a prolonged basis. So those are some of those signs we want to start to watch for. If we start to see credit spreads widen out, if we start to see earnings falter, some of those signals.
But that goes back to what you started off with, our consumer, you know, our consumer confidence remains high.
Right.
Maybe not as high as it was a year ago, but we're still, people are buying things and they still think things are good. And construction's made, even through the tariffs, we're still constructing and manufacturing things. So I don't know.
And people are still.
My layman's thing, I'm just confused.
You know, I don't think it's layman because I'll go back to one of the first presentations I got as a new graduate was at PIMCO, a guy who's done quite well, maybe for good reasons and bad reasons, and Bill Gross. And I got a pretty famous guy relative to markets and investing, and he said just that. He said, when there's too much data out there, you know, your point of safety is the consumer, and take a look at the consumer. And a lot of times it will get you out of the mire of endless economic data. And both personally and professionally, when I see a chink in the armor relative to the U.S. consumer, that's when I'm going to be concerned.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about government debt? I mean, so we have the...
No.
There's a lot of it. So it kind of goes back to my goal. Is that now an irrelevant data point as well? I mean, government debt just keeps rising and rising, and it doesn't seem to cause any problems, right?
Not just no, but God, no. sooner or later, we're going to have to address that. You know, there's so many questions related to that, the demographics. It's hard for me. I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, but it's interesting. It's interesting.
But you have a conspiracy theory?
Relative to these negative global yields and the amount of debt out there.
There's a relationship.
Your own.
Okay. All right. I know it makes me nervous, especially now that the Republicans don't think that government debt is a problem. It makes me super nervous.
I hope both sides of the aisle can get on. Hopeful they can get on the same page relative to trying to get the spending under control.
Yeah, it's just not sustainable, don't feel like, right. but it's been sustainable for a number of years now.
And unfortunately, until it becomes just such a bad situation, it forces the hand,
right?
You know, of all the individual interests of the senators, of the House committee members, and members of the House relative to their own constituents and their own, you know, portion of the country that they're representing, that, you know, it has to overcome those individual interests and those local interests. And until it becomes so bad,
it's going to have to be a crisis to do that. Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then well, where were you? Where were we all at when we were steering the boat,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah, there'll be a lot of those articles.
It's the day.
Yeah. Any questions on the economy? Well, we've talked a lot about the economy, but the portfolio, anything like that? Okay.
It's hard to get excited about 1% returns, but I guess they're better than 0%.
Better than zero, better than 25 basis points as it was for a while. And again, we're, you know, it's interesting to think we're quote unquote locking in yields at a 154, but we think that it's likely, not guaranteed, but likely that we are relative to what the rate will be. You know, we were talking about. In fact, Beth, you brought this up, you know, how many times we do this year, and we're thinking, I'll probably be back after the end of the calendar year. And interesting, and, you know, we'll make some notes relative to where we are then, relative to the Fed. Have they followed through with what we're talking about, what the portfolio looks like, and the portfolio yield versus local government investment pool. Again, there's no guarantees that we're going to be higher than the pool, but I think it's likely, based on the outlook of the Fed, that we will be. Not only that, that the portfolio will be generating a level of income that's much higher than if you were just stayed in.
So my understanding is that thanks to our new treasurer, we've moved some money out of non-interest-bearing bank accounts into some interest-bearing accounts. So the big picture is, I always struggle with this number, with our total portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So that number is, as of July 31st, $31.7 million. Is that
correct? That's the managed.
That's the
managed part.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So
that's
do you total. Have the total portfolio down here? We don't have all these pretty colored pages for that, but we do have...
This one on page 29, is it?
We do have the holdings, so they're consolidated. On page 37, the very last page, there you can see the total, that $37 million.
Okay, so you guys...
The total is 29.
Yes, 29.
Yep, page 29.
This is a person without glasses.
53 million, 337.
29.
This is $53 million.
Yes. Yep.
And what portion of that is that you guys are managing?
So basically, you can take it out primarily and get their color trust. It's on that same page and CSIG.
Take out that $20 million, the $19.8 million.
Right.
That'll
well,
be
and
almost
that will be decreased to over the next few minutes. And also the CDs on the previous page. So we invested about $7 million over the last quarter into the managed portfolio.
From the local government investment.
Right, that's right. We're targeting another three in the next few years.
So practically speaking, Lane, I mean, This speaks to the whole, I mean, the $53 million, we have, in addition to that, we have a certain amount of money just in bank accounts, so you keep that as small as possible, right?
Yeah, we're finding out where that sweet spot is.
Approximately, where's that? Seven?
Five. Gotta have cash flow to pay the checks.
No, I understand, yeah. At one time, that number was much higher. And so we brought that down for making extra interest.
And we kept some money in the local government investment pools too, just so we could kind of see what the feds were going to do and what the prediction would be for the last half of this year. And now that they have made their decision, it kind of gives us the indication of where we're going to go with that money too. Well, I understand about 10% more than I did last time. So
it's
moving, going somewhere.
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of what we do with our treasurer and with the investment folks is built on trust. I mean, you know, it's not something that we're going to be doing a very good job of micromanaging.
I think the biggest thing that, you know, we just need to understand what Scott said is we're going to try to lock in some money right now before we see that 1% coming up in the next year.
Right.
And even though it might not be as higher, you know, if we would have locked it in 2018, which would have been great, but it was a little rocky there for a second, so we were going to see what happened before we locked that money down.
What happens when we're invested in 1, 2, or 3 year securities and we have some kind of emergency and we need to take that money, but we need that money? What kind of penalty do we pay?
Everything is liquid. We could get it for you the next day. But in terms of the last part of your question, so we could get it for you, say, to liquidity yield, but it's dependent upon the movement of interest rates. Because if interest rates, say, they moved up 150 basis points, then not all, but most of the portfolio would be, quote unquote, underwater. So you would sell that security at a loss instead of. So you purchase the security, let's say, at a yield, we'll just use the latest example, 1.54%. You had an emergency in 3 months, and interest rates shockingly go the other direction, which no one expects, but they did. And you would realize, not 1.54%, you'd realize a loss, but your return to that loss would, just to throw out a number, would probably, just by example, be 1%, not negative.
Right.
You know, it could be, but then we're really talking about.
But practically speaking, this money really is pretty close to.
Yeah, and even when we had the conversation, if you remember, about, you know, moving from the 2 year benchmark to the 0 to 3 year and what risk that entails, and it was minimal versus the added value of managing for set portfolio. And we're still going to be structuring the portfolio, yes, buying out 3 years, but also managing the portfolio where we have a significant portion of it within 6 months to maturity.
Right.
And so even if rates go against you, you know, we get a call, an emergency call, hey, we need $4
million. Right.
We need it yesterday.
Right.
Especially now, if interest rates go down, who knows? But if interest rates go down 75 basis points, it's likely that, hey, we need $31 million. Yeah, we would not only be liquidated, but we would realize a significant gain.
And that's part of the reason for staggering purchases, too. When we decide, you know, Lane decided, okay, it's a good time, let's go ahead and move some money into the portfolio. We don't want to do it all at one time, right? Because we don't exactly know where rates are going, when they're going there, by how much. So we have our view, certainly, but it helps to stagger it as well.
And our local government investment pool is where we would pull money from first.
First, right. Yeah. We'd have to be in serious trouble.
Yeah. It'd
be a really big fire.
Yeah.
But
you guys still maintain.
Mm-hmm. Great.
All right.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you very much.
Always interesting.
Yeah, that's bad about having your cell phone number.
All right, we're here for our 1 o'clock item. We have Mel Stewart here to talk about appointments to the Rock County EMS Advisory Council. Mel?
I sent you a communication form to just update you on the representatives from the various agencies. The new agency, which is the last agency listed, is FEMA Emergency Care. They submitted a letter to Rock County EMS Council asking if they could be voting members on that council. According to our bylaws, they are eligible to be a voting member. We voted at our July meeting to support that, and then I'm bringing it to you for your approval. The members would be Dr. Dallas Bales is the primary, and Dr. Matt Freeman is the alternate.
Who else is on the
council?
Yeah.
So you update these appointments?
The way we wrote our bylaws is if there aren't any changes, we don't have to do anything, but if there's changes in membership, then the agency submits a letter to the council, and I'll bring it to the county commissioner saying there's been a change in
appointments from those agencies for the representation. One item of note is that each entity can have a representative in an alternate. And the reason I say that is Rapp County, for example, has one representative and one alternate. There's been some questions in the past, well,
yeah, I think we could.
Why don't we have the emergency manager on there and the airport fire rescue director and the comm director all having representatives? And years ago when we put the bylaws together, the intention was that each entity would have a vote basically on any matters that we were here, and it wouldn't be weighed by having multiple representatives from one entity.
Wouldn't the multiple representatives from the one entity need a caucus or whatever you want to say, or have to get together? Right. Remind us what this group does. It comes up with EMS protocols for ambulance delivery and the rest.
This group is the Rapp County EMS Advisory Council, sent out advisory council to the Rapp County Commissioners. We meet every other month. We talk about topics and issues related directly to emergency medical and trauma care throughout our county.
Make sure I hit everybody.
And it goes, a lot of what we do is training. We talk about talk about training and ensuring we're all at the same level of training. We talk about our medical directors there. And we have medical directors now. We have two medical directors that service all of our agencies. And they update the protocols once a year. They'll update us throughout the year of what's coming, but at the end of the year, at the beginning of the year, they update the protocols. We also have a countywide service contract on our cardiac monitor defibrillators, and those are on cardiac monitor defibrillators that are on transport units, so ambulances. And we get a group discount. We get a discount by having them all under one service plan. The county, through monies that we get from the state, subsidizes that service plan. It's gotten to the point that it's expensive enough that agencies also have to contribute into that. The county used to just pay for it out of that money we received from the state, but we don't have enough money in there anymore to be able to do that. So, kind of a long story. We do a lot of things, and really it's a surrounding provision of EMS and trauma care in our county. We do ambulance. We review the ambulance licenses. I, as the chairman, review all those licenses presented to as the county commissioners. I'll be coming back before you in about 2 weeks to get a permit, or to ask you to approve a permit for the private ambulance services working here. They got one permitted. They're getting a second ambulance online, so they've submitted that paperwork and payment. So I'll be back before you here in about 2 weeks.
Sounds good.
Just for the record, what does EMS stand for?
Emergency Medical Services.
I thought so. Thank you.
So is there any limit on how many people? So if somebody comes in, you guys review it. I think it's probably great. More the merrier, who wants to come and participate in the rest.
Right. No, there's no limit as long as they're directly related in providing emergency medical services and trauma services within Rapp County.
You ready, sir?
I think so, yeah. I'm struggling with this newfound power here, but go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I move we approve the additional membership to the Rapp County EMS Advisory Council and approve the recommendation from the EMS Advisory Council to include that new member. And that new member was, again, let me find it here again, Steamboat Emergency Center.
Second. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you, Mel.
Thank you.
Hold on a second. Can I get myself back?
It's hard when you're at the top to get
everything taken care of. I know. It's lovely at the top. So we are here for our 115 item with our Human Resources Director to talk about the UMR Advanced Claim Review Program.
Yes, I am here for you to consider approving our participation in this UMR Advanced Claim Review Program. This program is expected to offer between 14 and 28% in incremental savings. Basically, the program includes an additional claim review for professional coding accuracy and increased savings. So what they do is they have a team of board certified medical directors that review claims and records to make sure that all the coding is accurate and make sure that what monies they're expecting UMR or us to pay are actually justified. So rather than us or UMR going ahead and paying these, they're looking at the claims a little bit closer so that they're not going back to get monies, but they're paying accurately from the get-go. And the charge for this is basically there isn't a charge if we get savings. UMR charges a 30% fee based on the total savings of each claim. It will end up being billed as part of our monthly invoice, but even though we are getting billed that, essentially we're getting 70% of the savings of what they're finding.
It's a racket.
Yeah, well, it's one would think, on the outside looking in, that this would be their job in the first place.
One might think that.
And we're not shooting messengers, so I'm just so you know.
One might.
Help me visualize what, I mean, each month they will present a list to us that shows this is what the provider would have charged, and that these and each individual line item, this is the savings that was realized.
So I am not exactly sure the different ways we'll be able to see this. I know that they will have a portal that we expect that we'll be able to go into to see that information. I don't necessarily know if that level of detail will be provided each month. I think that I got the impression that they'll be billing us each month, but for the 30% will come in on our monthly invoice, but the savings will have to go onto a portal to view how that was all processed. But they just made this effective July 1st, this program, so I only know what they've told me, and they've told me a few different things so far.
So, frankly, I'm a little reluctant to move forward with this, not having a real true understanding of what their accountability to us will be. I can get over the part about I kind of think this is what they should have been doing in the first place, which would be doing everything they can to save us money. Mm-hmm. So maybe I can kind of understand that they're offering a service above and beyond what we may reasonably have expected in the first place. So I'm kind of okay with that. And I like the idea that we would save money. I think that's a great idea. But I just want to be sure that, you know, I just don't want to get a bill every month and say, here's a bill for $12,000 because we saved you X amount of dollars. And well, how do we know that you saved us that money? And I think it's a little unfair for the expectation for us to go through their portal and try to figure it out. I mean, how many cases are they going to be reviewing? We don't have that many employees. It doesn't seem like it would be that hard for them to provide a spreadsheet to us. It's a case number 427. The original bill was for $2,000, but we got it knocked down to $1,200 equals $800 of savings, of which we took 30%.
Pretty much all of our invoicing just comes with a total amount. We need to go into the website to access that information.
Yeah, I'm dead set against this right now. I think it's a scam. It's a racket. And they should have been doing this in the first place. And then my biggest concern is who's saving money here? Are we saving money, or are we just taking it out of the hides of our beneficiaries, which are our people that are insured, our employees? And so, you know, so who's really paying, you know, and we already in, already have, we're providing service for through Direct Path and the rest to help navigate this system that they've created themselves. And so I think for right now, we can, I assume, join up at a later point in time. I just think this is just a typical insurance scam.
Are they going to have anything for us to sign?
Yeah, there will be.
When are we going to get that?
I mean, what would be nice would be to have a representative from UMR. I mean, would that be possible for them to come here and talk to us and really give us a full explanation of the program and the exactly what accountability looks like? And I think the biggest thing is what Doug said, which is, will it be a situation where our employees go and get a service that they that we would have paid otherwise, and they find out, nope, we don't cover that, you're out of pocket. And we instituted a program to save the county money on the backs of our employees. I'm not saying that's the case, but I just don't know that it isn't the case.
So for right now, I think we could just, you know, defer and
table this.
And table it, or just decline the offer for right now. You know, we're going to be coming back. When do you have scheduled for our annual review with Hayes?
Hayes is going to be here on Monday of next week.
But when are they coming meeting with us, too?
Next Monday.
Next
here
Monday.
To us.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Do you think that they'll have some insight into this program?
Well, I attached a letter basically saying that Hayes recommended it, and all of their clients are moving forward with it.
Well, we may not be just like all of their other clients.
You know, especially, and really it kills me being self-insured. I could say my concern is that we're already, we have a medical system that's so cumbersome and so confusing and the rest. Do we think that we have an abuse of our situation out there, too? I mean, we don't get to see the claims. I mean...
Well, I would have to say that you're right. It is a very complex process, and as you know, coding, you know, claims get pushed back and forth because something wasn't coded correctly. And I know, just as in, you know, someone who's on the plan, that happens on a regular basis. So maybe hiring more people to be part of the process is value added for having those individuals maybe go through that process versus us as employees fighting that. I don't necessarily know if that's the case. But my guess is, based on additional people that they're bringing in, they're going to want to charge if there's some significant savings in the claim process.
When you were talking with UMR about this, I mean, I'm
Or did you talk to UMR about it?
I talked to Hayes about it. I did talk to someone last week, which is when I finally found out that they were going to, you know, make an amendment to the current agreement to move forward with it. And that's when they said that yes, you'll see the information on your monthly invoice, and there will be a portal where you will have access. I think because it's medical, a lot of times that information doesn't come through on the invoice. We have access to it, and actually the access is very limited, and typically
because of HIPAA.
So that's why. But there will be a portal that we can access that information, and they will be putting it on our invoice.
Tom?
I'm just sure you all remember that we actually told Hayes that we would participate, so we would have to give Hayes a call and tell him we want to rescind that until we have something in writing.
Yep.
It's fine.
Yeah, and I'm kind of envisioning that you would think that UMR would have produced some kind of a glossy 4-page color brochure, you know, talking about the benefits of the program and how it works. Or
it's not a glossy 4-page, it's a
Oh, right, yeah. It was one page.
Well, if you look online,
it is glossy on the
electronic property.
Well, and I would say that in the scheme of things, it is a program where you're technically not paying out of pocket for it.
Oh, yeah.
So
there's nothing to be lost except really the one thing that's at risk is what Doug talked about is the potential. I mean, I get beating up providers and getting them to control their costs. That's a good thing. I get us saving money, but if I could get that guarantee that it's not going to be taken out on the employees for services that we would otherwise think that they should receive, I'd probably be okay with it.
To be honest, I don't know how you control that, because if employees are submitting claims or getting treatment now that may be slipping through the cracks, then, you know, I guess you can make a judgment call on should they continue to get those or not get those.
The country go to a different insurance method. But
again, it should have been negotiated when we negotiated our contract with UMR in the first place.
Well, this didn't go into this program.
Oh, but it's additional, right?
I think my guess is that this is a perfectly good program. My guess is that it will benefit the county, but I'd like to understand a little bit more about the accountability of what that accountability looks like. I just get nervous with the idea that we're going to get an invoice for X number of dollars, and then it's up to us
to
engage in research to determine whether or not it's a valid bill.
That's what we have to do now.
But I was going to say, that's exactly what we have to do now.
I mean, you know, and it was difficult when I had my surgery last year, and the costs that were quoted for me from Direct Path, and then the costs that I saw from the final statement I got from our medical insurance, that statement had the total cost for my procedure as twice as much as what Direct Path said it was going to be. But then that's all I was charged, and that's all the county was charged. So I do not get how they came up with the final total cost after everything was supposed to be said and done. So it is complicated.
But we already had that. They already had got that done.
They did
it on my bill, too. Yes. I mean, they took care of what they were supposed to do.
That's right.
The physician billed out the physician assistant at the same rate as the physician.
Physician, yes.
He might have been more qualified.
Huh? So,
the PA might have been more qualified.
I don't know.
So let me ask you this question, Kathy. There's certainly it's not like this is a one-time only opportunity. A month from now, we could decide that we really wanted to engage in this.
Yeah, you haven't signed the agreement. I mean, I'm fine letting them know that we don't want to participate
at this time.
Right this time.
Let's move in that direction until we get a little more information.
Okay.
All right, Kathy. Thank
so,
you.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we decline the offer to participate in the UMR Advanced Claim Review Program at this point in time.
Second.
And any discussion that can be brought up at a later point in time or during our ACE discussion or our annual review of the insurance policy.
Okay. Sounds good. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you, Kathy, for bringing that forward.
You're welcome.
I'm not sure if Kevin's here for this next one.
So we are here for our 1:30 p.m. purchasing item. The purchase of a new fuel system and tank monitor upgrade at Yampa Valley Regional Airport. Kevin, what do you got for us?
So it's two projects rolled into one. So we, the airport, have a fuel farm that was put together in 2009, so it's 20 years old, and we had $50,000 in the budget this year to update the control system and put a new dispenser in it. And new controls all around, key activated instead of card activated, and that sort of thing. But then at the same time, we've had a project ongoing with the rental car. They're not using the fuel farm that we built for them back in the day. And I I think I gave you the wrong date. Ours was last put together in 2000. The rental car fuel farm was completed in 2009, so it's 10 years old. But it has never operated the way it should. It was not designed well for this elevation. It's got a suction pump instead of a positive pressure pump and a submersible pump. So they don't use it. So
where do they fuel up?
They go down to Hayden.
Oh.
So.
Oh, that's right. They've been doing that for a long time.
They have, yeah. I just didn't understand why, you know. And so anyway, we proposed to go with Eaton that has done some work for us. They're Sourcewell certified, so we're able to go with them and then combine two, so one mobility charge, two projects at the same time. Our project came in about $8,000 under budget currently, so it's going to cost us about $42,000. And we didn't have a budgeted item for the rental car fuel farm, so they've agreed, the two rental car companies have agreed to allow us to pay for this with CFC's customer facility charges. Some money that we collect from them as part of the rental fees. And we completely redesigned the system out there. So putting submersible pumps, we're going to keep the tank as is. Right now you can only fuel two cars at a time. We're going to move the whole island, the fueling island, away from the tank itself. And we're going to shrink the fence around the tank, because the tank does have to be fenced. That it'll allow fuel truck to get into it easier, so they don't have to manipulate their way in through the gate like they do now, or drag a long hose. And then it'll keep the refueling island completely separate and to the east of it. And so I think it's an improvement. Their own car companies are on board. It's a significant investment. It's about $168,000, I think, at the end of the day. But I have run it by them. No complaints or problems. Answered a few questions for them. Gave them the specs of the equipment that goes in, because they do these kind of projects themselves quite often. But they're happy to have us do it with the funds that we have kind of banked. And it's a great use of CFCs.
So this is just to fuel rental car?
So two. So our project on the is over on the maintenance side of the
runway. Okay.
And that's like where I fuel my car. And so we have diesel and MoGas over there. So that system will be upgraded. And then, yes, the bigger project is rental cars only. And like I said, they're on board with it.
Bottom line, it saves us money.
Saves us money. Our project is probably cheaper.
Because they can mobilize.
They can mobilize once to do both projects.
That's really where the savings is at.
Yeah. And it's probably scheduled for replacement anyhow. You said it's
ours is 2000. Ours was actually built in the 90s, early 90s. The last major maintenance we did was in 2000. So ours is 19 years old, and it's time to go. And theirs was never, like I said, this is bringing theirs up to a system like ours. So ours works with a pressure submersible pressure pump, and why they ever spec'd a suction system.
When you say suction, what do you mean by that?
So it actually, at the dispenser, it has a pump that sucks the gas out. So the submersible works much better.
Yeah, no, yeah. But
so they've always struggled with that. I didn't understand that until I finally asked them, why don't you use? I thought it had to do with maybe ordering fuel and
too complicated.
That, yeah. So.
So are we doing anything with the pump themselves? I mean, this includes
So it's a new pump, two dispensers. It's all the piping to go underground to take it from the existing tank for the rental cars out to this new long island. And so
does it include the island? The island's already there.
Nope. Includes the island, includes the grading, includes some concrete around it. All that's in the...
For safety specs, and so people don't drive over it and drive into it and the rest.
Yeah, and it lines up nicely. By the time we're done, we'll be ready to go, and it'll flow nicely into the rental car wash that I'll be back to talk to you about probably next year. So we hope to get that in January.
Out of CFCs as well.
Also out of CFCs. So we currently have about $1.2 million in CFCs, and needs to be spent, or we need to suspend the collection of CFCs. If you can't use the money, it's got to be something.
So that's why it was necessary to get buy-in from the rental car companies. You could have.
Yep. I mean, they could have queried me and said, you know, we still collect this amount on every rental car every day.
What are you doing with the money?
Yeah. I mean, it makes us.
But the idea is you turn around and spend it on operations to support their operations.
Yeah, we spend it. It's collected more than we spend because we use it to like seal coat the parking lot where their cars are and to do the paint and that stuff. But we haven't done any big projects. It's the kind of thing you use if you're going to build them like a parking garage.
Right.
That's typically what you use CFCs for.
Or the car wash,
yeah. And they're definitely on board with the car wash.
Oh, I bet.
But that's going to be, I mean, we will bring our CFCs down and need to start building them up again.
Right.
Well, and it is their CFCs too. Yeah. I think
exactly.
Knowledge.
Yeah,
it's not like it's ours.
Right now, if we had no plans for this, and they came to me and said, "We're going to stop collecting CFCs," I'd have to say, "Yeah,
right."
So, just one little question, maybe. So, the dispenser island, and you know, and especially these aren't people in coveralls and the rest, and they're not probably the. Like your staff and the rest, you know, is this thing going to have some type of cover on it or something?
No.
So it's open and bare to the world.
Yeah, but it's not rental car customers.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, it's rental car employees.
I see who brings down the cars to get washed and fueled.
Yeah, that's a good point. It doesn't include coverage from the car wash will.
Exactly, but I was just the cover from elements.
Right.
You know, wind or whatever. So, yeah. Well, I think it's a good start.
The rental car companies can buy those guys nice jackets and hats. So they'll be fine.
It's like a big family organization.
A windbreak over there. West side might be pretty good at times. I've seen it there.
Sounds good.
Are you ready?
Yep.
So we just have... So you got two different agenda items. So we'll work on the one for the airport first. So, Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the Sourcewell Cooperative Purchasing Program purchase and approve the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order to Eaton Sales and Service LLC as a distributor of Syntech Systems products for the replacement of the fuel management systems, additional pump, and repairs to the... Okay, never mind, we are going to do it in one motion. For the repairs to the rental car fuel farm in the amount of $168,541, as well as approve the replacement of the fuel management and monitoring system for the Yampa Valley Regional Airport fuel system in the amount of $42,131.75.
Second. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Actually, you're doing the motions. Oh, no, the chairperson does this much. I, acting as chair, move that the Board of County Commissioners go into executive session to receive legal advice concerning the county attorney pending matters list and the litigation and claim docket. This executive session is not being electronically recorded, as the county attorney is advised that the discussion is subject to attorney-client privilege. This is an executive session for conference with the county attorney for the purpose of receiving legal advice on specific legal questions under CRS section 24-6-402, parens 4, parens B. I caution each participant to confine all discussion to the stated purpose of the executive session and that no formal action may occur in the executive session. If at any point in the executive session any participant believes the discussion is going outside the proper scope of the executive session, please interrupt the discussion and make an objection. It is August 20th, and the time is 2:02 p.m.
Second.
Is there any further discussion?
So did you note in here who all is going to be in here?
No, I do that on the way out.
On the way out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Okay. The time is now 2:44 p.m. and the executive session has been concluded. The following persons were present at this executive session. Will you guys each say your names?
Commissioner Cargan.
Commissioner Beth Melton.
Doug Munger.
Tom Sullivan, County Manager.
Dan Weinheimer.
Linnea South.
Eric Knauss.
Susan Lewis.
The board limited its discussion to the purpose stated in the motion to go into executive session, and no formal action was taken. Thanks.